I saying? Okay, so by the time we finally got a center, I mean, we had a lot of trouble because people either wouldn't rent to us because we were a gay organization, or originally we wanted space that we could have dances in, and it was just too expensive. And we started out with a coalition of GROW, which is Gay Rights for Older Women, and Sisters of Sappho, and GROW had diminished to the point where by the time we had found a center, they couldn't promise financial support. You know, they said they would use the center and they would help support us, but they couldn't. They had planned to help us, you know, regularly with rent, you know, and move in as a coalition. We ended up having to get a center with the women's center and the karate class, which is part of the women's center. And that was, and we didn't have anything but office space, really, and we could use the karate room as for kind of a coffee house. So we ended up having to have dances at the Unitarian Church, which is where there used to be dances before there was never a gay center, at the Unitarian Church. So that was a real familiar place for people to go anyway. And from that time, Sisters of Sappho never rebuilt from the time that they had. It had been really big when it was at the gay center, like large workshops, lots of people at the meetings. And such a small group of people that helped, had stayed with it to, through all its problems to help find a center, that by the time we found the space, it was maybe a group of 8 women. And we had not been able to put out the Lavender Grapevine anymore, which is the paper that we put out, not been able to put out dances too regularly, not been able to do a lot of head workshops or do a lot of the creative stuff that we used to do because we just didn't have the woman power. And it never rebuilt from then. It became more and more of a small group of people. Although at different times, once we had the center, we had tried to branch out. It had gotten to the point so that there was, I guess, a small core group of people who pretty much dominated the direction of SOS, which didn't necessarily meet the community's needs anymore. So at its very end, I guess at the meeting where it was decided with, that it would not exist anymore, there was 3 women. And then there was a meeting afterwards to decide how it would be, how stuff that we owned would be distributed, and there was 7. So pretty much from the beginning to the end, I was involved in SOS. Although I had pretty much decided to quit before it folded because I didn't feel like it was meeting the community's needs. And I felt like people were dealing with things in the meeting so rigidly that it was impossible for it to expand enough to meet the community's needs. I didn't think you needed an organization or a center to have a dance, and that seemed to be all people were doing that really met community needs. So that's pretty much SOS. So, in between that time, there was the Villa, which had been the longest standing lesbian bar, had been open for 5 or 6 years for lesbians, right, which was a big deal. And before then, I guess there weren't hardly any bars, from what people say. And after the Villa, and during the time that it was still open, there was a bar on Virginia called The Shadows, which was open for a while. And then the owner burnt it down for insurance. And that had been a gay male men's bar that turned over. Most of the bars besides the Villa, and I'm not sure the Villa might have been a men's bar first. The women's bars were always first men's bars, and then another men's bar would open, and the women would have what was the men's bar. Now, the women's community doesn't seem to be able to support a large bar like the men's community. Women don't go out every night. Most women don't. Some women do, but not enough to maintain a bar to be exclusively gay. And a bar that's known to be gay, straight people won't go to. So unless it's like the Villa was a small bar, and I think that's why it lasted so long, and it's still open, and it's still pretty much gay, although on the weekdays they get kind of a mixed clientele at night. But the bars that we moved into after the men had been there, one by one, closed. I mean, they would only stay open a certain amount of time. And I think my theory is that we can't support a big bar. Women don't make the money that men do, first of all, and they don't go out and cruise like men do either, you know, which is why men go out every night. And there are not as many openly out lesbians as there are gay men. There are, I think there are probably as many lesbians, but they tend to stay home more. So, and a lot of them are very closeted and have jobs that they're afraid of losing, and so, anyway, that tends not to be so, although I think that upsets gay men too. It doesn't keep them home. Right? Nothing keeps them home. So, anyway, so then there was The Shadows, which was burnt down. There was Granny Goodness, which had been a leather bar, I guess a high school leather bar before, and which opened up specifically encouraged. All these bars always, like, they would go to the center with leaflets and they would let it be known through key people in the community that it was turning gay. They did publicity in the community explicitly to turn it gay. We would never just go out and try to take over a bar. No, none of us are that bold. So, then there was Granny's, which I guess was about to lose its license, you know. And after it closed, there was this big sign. It used to have this sign saying Granny's Goodness, and it had this big sign saying Granny's had straightened itself out afterwards, which was a slap in everybody's face. Real disgusting of them. Then there was, Jesus, what bars were there? I don't know, the Bocce Room, which was always a men's bar, but turned kind of women when Mean Alice's opened up. Oh, yeah, the Wonder Bar, which was a gay bar for a couple of days. And they also advertised in the community and put signs up at the center. And but the thing is, they wanted to be gay and straight at the same time, so they had all their straight clientele out in the front room where the bar was. Then they had a back room where they had Madeline Davis sing, you know, to try to, the first week, right, to try to encourage lesbians to come. But who was going to walk... First of all, who was going to risk going to Chippewa to a bar and then walk through this whole line of straight men to get into this room and listen to country western music on a jukebox?
And they would all stare at us as we would walk.
Right. And try to get in when they got really drunk. People would go in twos and threes because they were afraid. So that was that bar. Anyway, till now, I guess, then the Hibachi Room was... women for a while, right? It's always, you know, the men's leftovers pretty much are bars. And then they closed down. And I remember hearing the few gay men who were still going to the Hibachi Room when we were going, I remember hearing the gay men saying, well, the women are here, that's the kiss of death for a gay bar. Which is true, I think, close to. And now, the thing that was better about bars later on is that they were mostly owned by gay people, right? And that so it wasn't as bad as the Villa where, you know, somebody would come in and, like, literally threaten to throw you off the floor because you were kissing your lover's neck, you know, which is not really so erotic when you think about it. But it got to the point where it wasn't. There were bars that were mostly owned by gay men. Granny's was owned by a straight mafia man. And I think The Shadows was owned by a straight man, by the mafia. And I know that in one way or another, the mafia is... part of the gay bars. You're either paying money to them or paying money to them in the police, or you have to definitely get their okay to have a bar, but at least they're owned by gay people now. So, like, for instance, Ricardo's, I never felt that that there's anything that you could do there about being gay that you would be harassed about. You know, and that at any time when there's somebody walks off the street who's straight, and there is an interchange between them and the gay people in the bar, it's the owner always threatens to call the police on the straight man, not on the women. We're at Rosie's, which is owned by two gay women who are very closeted and paranoid. They always take the side of the straight people, always. They're so afraid they'll lose their license for their other bars. So that's the bars. What else? I came out to my parents after the first year and a half that I was out. You have to understand, my parents are like, their main concern is that I like them. It's a very peculiar relationship. They're very insecure people. So it wasn't a real big deal for me to come out to them. I came out to them because me and my lover were going to go down to visit, and I wasn't going to pretend you weren't lovers. So I called them and I told them. They were both on the phone. And let me see. My father told me that a year before then he had told my mother that there was a possibility that me and my brother were gay. And he had given her Well of Loneliness to read, which is the most god-awful book you could give a mother to talk about being gay. I mean, it's so depressing. It's like a life of misery mm-hmm. is what your daughter is looking forward to. So I said to him right then, because I had read it, I said, Dad, how could you? And my mother pretty much was like, she was concerned, could we still be close? Okay. But I know like a lot of the lovers that I've had and people I've talked to have had a much harder time coming out to their parents. And I've always been, when I talk to people in classes and stuff like that, and people have just come out, and when I did a lot of counseling at the center, I would never encourage someone to come out to their parents. I know of cases where people have been institutionalized if they're underage. I know of cases where people have been financially cut off while they're going to school, and of cases where they have been harassed by their parents, where they've been unable after that to see their younger sisters and brothers. So I would never counsel people that they should come out to their parents. It's all a matter of how important it is to them, how they think their parents will respond, whether or not there's a reason to it. There's no reason to. You know, it doesn't make, if you have no relationship with your parents, why torture yourself and them, right? If you're worried, if you have a close relationship and you want to try to breach that difference, because once you come out, there's nothing left you can tell your mother and father. Everything that you're involved in is, you know, in some way related to your being gay. Then if you want to maintain that close relationship, it might be worth the risk, right? Otherwise not. So I ended up deciding to do it for that reason, and because I felt that my parents and I had close to no relationship. It had been really hard, and my mother and I had been close before, and I felt that if we were to be close, then we had to bridge that. So it was worth the risk to me, just, you know, because otherwise it was really nothing, you know, for me to talk to them about, right? So my brother's response when I came out to them was, first of all, I told the folks, which I had, and second of all was, you know, I really envy you because at least you know who you are. My brother has always been tortured over his sexuality and whether or not he's gay, and his relationships with men have always been the strongest in his life, and I think he is gay, but he just doesn't deal with it, and so he was kind of envious, you know, and he's always upset that he'll make close male friends that he feels much closer to them than they feel to him. It reminds me a lot of what before I came out, how I felt about women. And then they go off with some girlfriend and they kill, you know, he'll make a plan with someone to buy a farm. He's into collective farming and stuff. And work off the land for a year, and in 6 months the person will be in a relationship with somebody and they won't do it with him. And he doesn't understand that because his commitment is pretty much to men. So my half-brother's response was really piggy. Really piggy. And after I talked to him twice, he knew my first lover, and so I came out to him much before I did anybody else. After the second time I talked to him, I told him that he was so obnoxious that I would not relate to him, and we had been really close, closer than anybody else in my family. He'd helped me move to Buffalo, and he'd really helped me in some dire times. Oh, he is really piggy. I mean, he's piggy about everything. He's a real obnoxious person. It took me a little bit by surprise. Our relationship had been going from being really close to being really, it had really dwindled. So I was kind of the last straw. But he said something so offensive to me. He said, Susan, you've talked to me about sex. I know you enjoy sex. You can't be gay. And I told him that really told me what he thought about women, you know, and that that's not how I felt about women, and that that really told me what he thinks about sex, you know, that sex to him is a prick, you know, and nothing else, and that was not the glory of sex to me. And so pretty much we didn't have any relationships since then. I find him more offensive.
When you're coming out, did you have any straight friends that you came out to, and how would they react?
Not really.
Not you.
Let me anything.
Did I?
I didn't see. Before I came out, I didn't have too many friends. And after, well, while I was working at Women's Studies, I met a couple of women who were straight that I was somewhat friends with. I was already out, though. And I found it difficult to maintain my relationships with them. They were always concerned over their sexuality, whether they were gay or straight, and they would always come to me and talk about it. And it was just a real drain, you know. And in the same way, a couple of women that I knew who had been lesbians who went back in the closet would come to me to talk about their life and what it meant to them now and their confusion over their sexuality. I just didn't want to hear it, you know. So I would just go along. You know, you'd think that somebody would encourage. I don't know. Like, I remember this one friend of mine who was my initiator in 213. Like, I told her, look, she had been in this relationship with this guy for 3 years, really nice guy. You know, and she was always saying, you know, she was saying, look, I go and I do this women's movement work, and then I go home to Joe, you know, and she says, and I don't know, you know, if I should be doing that. And I said, look, you like Joe, you get along well with Joe, you know, whether you're gay or straight, you know, you don't think about it in your head and then go do something, you know. And I told her to just forget it, you know, that if it became important to her and if she was gay, she would come out, but it's not a decision you take because, you know, your political work conflicts with your personal life. I mean, it's not. There was a time when the Furies were putting out this position that feminism is the theory and lesbianism is the practice, and that the ultimate goal, it was like the ultimate goal of feminism was to be a lesbian because you're not supporting men anymore. And I think people still suffer under that delusion, because I don't agree with that at all. I think that you're either gay or you're not, pretty much. You know, and that some people do come out who aren't gay, and they don't stay out because nobody would live that oppressive lifestyle if they didn't have to. Nobody will keep doing it. Nobody will put up with only two places you can go where you can act queer. You know, nobody will put up with the strain that puts on your relationship. You know, that everything else around you tells you you're fucked up or that you don't exist. I mean, nobody's going to do that if they don't have to. So eventually, those people do not stay out.
Jobs you've worked in where you didn't come out?
Oh, I never came out on a job. Never.
Yeah, where
did
you work?
Okay, I worked in a program for autistic kids. And most of the kids in the program were male, and that didn't particularly upset me, but I knew if any of the people I worked with thought that I was gay, that it would upset them. So, as a matter of fact, I worked there just before I was breaking up with my first lover, my second lover, they all kind of come together, okay. When I was breaking up with my second lover, and I went to work one day really upset, and I had to explain it in terms of me and my boyfriend breaking up, that we'd been together for X amount of time. So I didn't find that particularly difficult. I didn't find it self-effacing or anything. That was just what you had to do.
Something ever come up?
No. One of the jobs that I worked in, another job I worked in Children's Hospital, in the adolescent program, I always found it difficult because you couldn't have any relationships with people in the office because you were gay and they were straight. And most of the things that women support each other around are heterosexuality. They're all attached to heterosexuality, so you're not going to get that kind of support. So after my first job, I realized that I was not going to get that kind of support. I didn't look for it. You know, I had congenial relationships with people at work. Occasionally I went out for a drink or two with them in a bar right around the corner from where I worked. I never made any plans with them at night. And if I had to say that I was in a relationship with someone, I told them a man's name. And whenever I thought or said anything about my lover, I would just say he instead. And again, that didn't particularly upset me. I know it does really upset other people, but I had been out for a long time. And for a longish time, I don't know what it's relative. And it didn't upset me. You know, I just thought that's what you have to do to survive. It didn't, you know, I didn't internalize it or anything. I thought it was fucked up, but it was, you know, how things were. Then I worked in a program called Hopeville Home for Girls, and it was dealing with adolescent girls. And in that place, I was queer baited a lot. Because there are all these girls who are just in the time where they're developing a sexuality, and they're all, they're, it's a residential program, they're all institutionalized there for different reasons, being truant or shoplifting or shit like that. So they're really freaked out, and they're all really afraid of being queer, and they make jokes about it all the time. And the worst thing they can say about somebody when somebody's being a bitch is to call them a dyke or a lesbian. So that really freaked me out. I was starting to get gay bait a lot. I let my hair grow to deal with it. I came home really freaked out. I was jumped a couple of times by different girls. Like, they would always deal with, they were pretty physically aggressive girls. What I don't mean sexually jumped, I mean attacked brutally a couple of times. And I was working in this one particular cottage. Also because I have no particular, I was one of the few staff who had no particular physical fear of the women there. I mean, they were all like street kids, and they were all ferocious in their own way, but I was taking karate. I have always had a sense of my physical strength. I'm a strong person, and they didn't scare me. You know, I wasn't even particularly scared. Like, most of the staff members were scared of the idea of one woman physically confronting them. And I found it more direct than the kind of catty shit that I was used to, you know, backbiting and stuff like that. So I thought, you know, well, at least if these women hate your guts, they're going to tell you right out they hate your guts. And if they ever have a chance, they're going to punch you in the face, and you're going to tell them, and I'll punch you right back, and they'll leave you alone, you know? So at a certain point, I had not wanted to talk about a boyfriend anymore, you know, and that's, in that job I realized that it was really probably going to be necessary for the rest of my life, you know, to talk about my relationships in terms of them being with men and lie. And so I did, and sure enough, a week after that, everything had cooled out. Everybody asked me once about my boyfriend, was relieved as hell to find out I had one, and never asked again. They just wanted to know that he was there. And so I told them, and everything cooled out, and I didn't get bothered after that at all. So that's for the last job that I worked in a factory, and I got queer baited there because I was working at, well, at first I got hired for this one job, and I was working two jobs, and then a job that had always been a men's job opened up, and I bid for it. And I ended up, they wouldn't give it to me because I was a woman, I ended up having to file sex discrimination charges to get it, and all the other women in the plant filed with me. So as soon as they heard that I had filed charges, they gave me the job thinking that I couldn't do it. But I was physically very fit. It was a very strenuous job. Like, I had to do things like lift 120-pound pails and shit. So I was working all the time lifting heavy stuff, and I was really strong. I was strong from working out, and I ran. And I did the job, and I surprised everybody. And
they harassed you a lot?
They harassed me at first a lot. And although they never came out and called me gay, there was, but that's especially surprising because I thought my foreman was, because he was really freaked out that I had put him in a bind where he had to hire me. But my foreman, after the first 3 weeks that I worked there, didn't give a shit because I did the job well. And I did the job, it turns out, I did much more work than the guy who had worked in the job, so he's more than pleased with me. And he thought I was an aberration for being that strong, but he just always dealt with it like I was young and strong, and, you know, he talked about my Prince Charming and shit, and he never dealt with the fact that I was queer, although I'm sure it occurred to him. There was another woman in the plant who was gay, and she turned out, she was the woman, an older black woman, who helped train me, and we became very close friends. And went out together after work and stuff like that. She worked two jobs, and she backed me up a lot, although it was never, and people knew that she was gay because she had made the mistake of telling somebody and who she thought she could trust, and they had spread it. Okay, so I guess through our relationship, although we didn't have an overt relationship except that we backed each other up, and I didn't work with her after I worked this other job, I guess people assumed it too. And the women never harassed me. It was the men who were really offended by the fact that I was doing a men's job and constantly had to deal with it, although they saw that I did the work. And they had to ask me for help for their jobs sometimes, like lifting heavy bales and shit like that. They would never deal with the fact that I was competent. at the job and always acted like I couldn't do things. And if they didn't have to let me do things, or if they could try to help me do things, they would, so that they would feel less threatened. So that was heaven for me. It wasn't personally thrilling at all for me to show that I could break my back. So anytime they wanted to help me, it was great, you know? Like, it upset me the first two times, and I thought, shit, I'm getting paid $3 an hour for busting my ass, and anything that they need to do of my work, you know, so that they can get their male egos soothed, great, you know? So that was one of the things I realized, you know, and it didn't make me feel any less competent, because they still had to come to me, you know, to help when we were short and stuff, and I still did everything that they did, you know, which they had said no woman could do, you know, so I knew that I could do it, so it didn't upset me. And as time went on, I realized that I had, and I talked to the women, and I realized I was being more competent than I had to be. And so I started slowing down. Because I found out that the guy who had had my job had had the foreman, had helped him all the time. And I was doing the job alone, you know, and once I realized that, I would just say, hey, you know, Herb, I need help. You know, and it was no personal ego problem to say that, because, right, so, like, I knew, right, at first that was true.
Well, you beat the test anyway.
Right, right, and then after that, it didn't bother me to say that I needed help. Yeah. I said it when I was tired, and I just didn't want to have to hassle it. I mean, I always knew in my work that I was getting ripped off, you know, and so I felt no personal need to prove anything, except as far as so that I could keep the job. I wasn't trying to make a giant step for womankind. I was simply, because I got that job, I was able to get by only working one job.
Did it change though when the guys realized after a while?
So one particular guy was really freaked out by it, and he's the guy who gay baited me. Him and then later a friend of his worked there for a little while in the summer. They baited me a little. They would talk to each other, like they would talk out loud. They worked in the press next to me, and they would say out loud, we know about Susan or something like that. I remember one time they were doing it and it was bugging me, and I turned around and I said out loud to him, you know, Tim, you're really an asshole. He was like this 19-year-old punk, you know. I said, you're really an asshole. And then I just did my work for the rest of the day. I didn't give a shit what he said. He was like, it was funny. So different, he would incite people, men, like the men went in and out of that job. You know, because $3 an hour is not much to pay someone for that kind of backbreaking work. And I told Herb one day that he would be better off letting women work that job, because women, $3 an hour, a lot of women, that's a lot of money. I mean, the women who were working in the plant were making less than I was making. So that's pretty much my work relationships. And what I found is that anything I had to do to get along, whether it was to lie that I had a man, or, you know, to work harder, to work less hard, or whatever, I would do, you know, and I wouldn't feel bad about it. I wouldn't feel like I was betraying myself, that I had to come out of the job. I mean, I just think it's foolish to come out on the job. You need it to live, you know, and you're at the mercy of your boss, so why? You know, why do it if you don't have to?
Did you have to have survival techniques, like in the work with SOS or Stroke Community, how they...
Well, when I was going to the university, I went and talked at a lot of classes. I was in the Speakers Bureau of SOS. I did Dyke for a Day all the time. I did it in the psychiatry department. I did it in the medical school. I did it at night schools. I did it in high schools. I was, like, out all over the place. And then when I got out of the university, I didn't do that anymore, you know, because you just don't. Any place that you go could be, you could work with somebody the next year. We'd been there, you know, so I got a little more realistic about it. When I was in SOS, the first maybe 5 months of SOS, we found out that a woman who had come to one of our original meetings had been an FBI informer, and that she had taken a list of all the people at the meeting, and I was on the list. I'm sure they have a wonderful file about me. Anyway, they keep track of gay organizations and stuff. It doesn't particularly bother me that much. I mean, they won't intervene unless it could be upsetting if you have a government job. But I'm not really interested in having a government job, so it doesn't particularly bother me. So I would say that being an SOS was my strategy for survival. It was how to get support for being gay, you know, and not that I had to have a strategy to be an SOS. And it was doing gay work that made me feel saner. And it still does.
did you ever get canceled by straight people, like, working with the dances or anything that was public?
The dances aren't really public. I mean, people don't... Like every now and then somebody would walk up the stairs to the center or to the church, and you would just go up to them. Like, I never felt like I couldn't do that, and I would say that it was an all-women's dance, and would they please leave? There was a couple of times where other people had gone up and done that who were getting harassed, where me and other women had to go over. But when you have 150 women in a room and two assholes, you know, upstairs, you do not feel like you can't deal with it.
It would never be more than maybe three men and all the biggest women.
Would just walk over and say, listen, you're just going to have to leave. And what would be passed around then is people would know. Like, I remember a couple of times when there were guys hanging out outside the center, and we would announce at the dance that people should not leave alone. And we escorted people. I remember a couple of times escorting people to cars. I remember once this woman, Michelle, was attacked on her way out of the center. And what she did is she ran into her car, and the man broke the windshield of her car and tried to get at her. Another man was, they were really drunk, and women went down and chased them off. So that's the only physical confrontation I remember out of a dance, right? Although people leaving bars, I think in general tend to be careful not to go alone, you know, at different times.
Is that or not? Is it harder back then?
I think maybe more conscious about it then. I wish that women would be more conscious about it now, too, because I don't think it's particularly safe, you know. I think that... To have, especially when there was a gay community service center, to have, it's different at a dance, the Unitarian Church. People don't know really when they are unless you're gay. But when you're in a building with disco music on and lights and stuff like that, and the door says gay community service center, you know, you have to know that, you have to know that you have to be careful. I think people were pretty careful at the center because they had to be. And at the, when we had the lesbian center, we had people staffing. We made sure that our hours ended at 8, so that people could leave home when it was still early, and we wouldn't let anybody staff alone. Although it wasn't a particularly dangerous neighborhood, much less so than the gay center had been. But just because I don't think women should take chances they don't have to take. So we always made sure, unless it was a night when the karate school was there, because they could open and close up and you could leave with them. And the women in the karate school, that was true of. To any place that you know that women are, people get to know that women are together a lot, you have to be careful.